Welcome to the sixth edition of the Soho Forum. I'm Gene Epstein, economics and book review editor of Barron's Financial Weekly and the director of the Soho Forum. The Soho Forum, again, has a twofold mission. First, to prevent sizzling debates between brilliant people on issues that interest freedom-loving folks. And second, and just as important, the Soho Forum is meant to be a place where people can socialize and get to know each other. That's the purpose of the wine and cheese reception, which has already started and will last until 9 o'clock. The Soho Forum is a labor of love for me, in part because it's run by a group of loving volunteers that include my wife, Isako Kobayashi, who provides all the food, my friends John Kunze and Andy Aiken. We have a great time, and thanks especially to the Smith Family Foundation for providing us with the financial backing. If anybody else in the audience is interested in volunteering for future Soho Forum events, again, it's a lot of fun. The advantage now is you get in for nothing. If you provide a little work for us, and so see me afterwards if you're interested in that. Tonight's resolution reads as follows. U.S. immigration policy should be to issue migration visas without any numerical limitations. Focus on that first sentence, first part of the sentence. U.S. immigration policy should be to issue migration visas without any numerical limitations. The next part of the resolution has a couple of provisos. To all applicants who are not on a terrorist watch list and who do not otherwise have criminal records or contagious diseases. We're going to have a couple of little acts before then, but meanwhile, I want Naomi Brockwell to come on stage and explain to you how the voting works. Naomi, please provide your explanation. Thanks.
Okay, so for anyone who's been here before, it's the same deal. Anyone who's not been here, if you look around the room, you will see our Wi-Fi password and network name. If you connect to that, then you will go to sohovote.com, and you're going to cast your votes online. So we do two rounds of voting at the Soho Forum. We vote before the debate, and then we vote again after the debate, so we can see who sways the opinion the most. So again, that's sohovote.com. You go there, and you just click vote on yes, no, or undecided, and that's all you need to do until the end of the debate.
You will vote yes, no, or undecided on that proposition, and then after the debate, you will vote again. And whoever moves the needle in his favor wins the Tootsie Roll, wins the debate. So think about that. Think about the resolution while we have a couple of preliminaries. First, I want to ask Ron Lichtman of the Manhattan Libertarian Party to come to the stage to say a few words. Ron, take it away. Please come up. And
thank you, Gene. And thank you for putting together these provocative and well-organized programs. I'm Ron Lichtman. I am chair of the Manhattan Libertarian Party. The Manhattan Libertarian Party is dedicated to presenting to the general public through electoral candidacies the sorts of ideas that we debate and discuss amongst ourselves here, but as a political party, we participate not only to preaching to our choir, but to our fellow voters and fellow Americans. All of New York City is up for election in 2017, from the mayor, the public advocate, the controller, the city council, and the borough presidents. And we hear that some of our progressive friends are planning to capture the steam and the heat that they generated out on the street in their marches and organize their candidacies. We should not let that go by default. So it is my mission, and the mission of the Manhattan Libertarian Party, to encourage all of you and anybody you know to step up and run for public office, take the opportunity to really make a difference. As I say, the Manhattan Libertarian Party gives us the opportunity not just to make noise, but make a difference. Come see me. Thank you.
Thank you,
Gene.
Thanks. Ron has already been turned down by John Stossel, who's been given that offer many times. And even though I'm a Bernie Sanders lookalike and could probably take Gracie Mansion, I unfortunately don't have the time either. That's where you come in. See if you want to run. Thanks, Ron. And Ron really is a very solid guy and a very good guy to work with. So I'm being serious. Maybe a young person can take a shot at the city council and Ron can raise you some money. The usual pattern at the Soho Forum is to have our warm-up act. This time it's going to be Andrew Heaton. Andrew is, as some of you know, the author of Laughter is Better Than Communism, that very contentious title that he chose to call his collection of essays. He's now come out with two new novels, I believe. At least one of them is new. One of them is called Happier Than Werewolves. He's selling books in the back, and he is here to do his warm-up act. Take it away, Andrew. Please come to the stage. We are now closing the voting, I take it. And because you've all made up your mind, whether you're yes, no, or undecided on the resolution, U.S. immigration policy should be to issue migration visas without any numerical limitations to all applicants who are not on the terrorist watch list and who do not otherwise have criminal records or contagious diseases. Speaking for the affirmative will be the guy in orange, Ben Powell. And speaking for the negative will be the gray-haired guy, Mark Krikorian. Mark is the director of the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, D.C. Go on the website to read about his other achievements. Ben is an economist and editor of the book, The Economics of Immigration. When I was thinking of setting up this debate, I asked, got Ben Powell lined up, and I asked George Borjas, the professor of economics from Harvard, who specializes in immigration, with whom Ben has actually had a number of public disputes, polite public disputes, if he'd be willing to step into the ring against Ben in a public forum. He declined the offer to do so. So Ben is obviously a pretty fearsome debater, but Mark Krikorian is not the least bit afraid of him. So we look forward to an exciting confrontation. There are flyers of the book Economics of Immigration that Ben has edited on the table. I also noticed that The Economics of Immigration is on sale on Kindle. Ben, you have 15 minutes to defend the proposition U.S. immigration policy should be to issue migration visas without any numerical limitations to all applicants who are not on a terrorist watch list and who do not otherwise have criminal records or contagious diseases. Take it away, Ben.
All right. Thank you very much, Gene, and all of you. By thank you very much, Gene, I also mean thank you for having a real comedian talk before an economist, because we already have such a great reputation for entertaining audiences that if you start with one of them, it's only going to be onward and upward from there. I'm sure that's what you're all thinking as soon as they let me have the mic. So let me begin with a thought, and I'm going to do this a couple different ways. And you had a Libertarian Party person speak, and I'll do a little bit of a Libertarian two-step in this talk and talk about a couple of different moral foundations for this. But the one I want to start with is a rights-based one, and not a rights of an immigrant to migrate. I believe in property rights. I believe in boundaries. I believe in the ability to exclude. The fence around my property, my justly owned property, should be able to prevent other people from crossing it, regardless of their nation of birth, including the United States. But with that property and with those rights, I believe we have a freedom of association, a freedom to associate with anybody that we believe that we can mutually benefit by associating with. That means if I would like to rent to somebody, sell my home to somebody for them to be a permanent resident, employ them on my property, assuming somebody else can let them reside on theirs, I should be free as a property owner in the United States to be able to do so. The only restriction that should be on that is if there is some demonstrable, obvious harm that is unjustly caused to other people in this country. That's the beginning filter of this, not an inherent right to migrate. If we're going to have quantitative restrictions on immigration, by what right, by what harm do we say that I should not be able to freely associate with somebody just because they were born on the other side of a line some politician drew on a map? Then we can talk about the consequences of migration. This goes in the same direction, I think, actually. In fact, in terms of the economic impact of this, it's overwhelming. So there is no policy that any economist could advocate for that would do more to increase global wealth than the decreasing of the barriers to labor mobility across countries. The estimates of this are jaw-dropping, staggeringly huge. At the lower end, 50% of world GDP if all countries remove their quantitative restrictions on migration. The upper end, 150%. On average, a doubling of world GDP. Whatever problems Mark's going to point out when he begins talking, ask yourself, if it's just the United States changing policy, we're not going to double global income, but we'll significantly increase the income of those who come here and the native born here. With that big increase, could we reallocate some of that percentage to deal with whatever problem he brings up? In thinking in a global context, it's really hard to come up with problems that a doubling of global income couldn't address the negative consequences better than saying, no, you shouldn't be able to cross the border and freely associate with somebody who would benefit from associating with you and you them. So what are the popular hobgoblins here in the United States of the problems with immigration? These, by the way, Gene mentioned that George Borjas was invited to do this. And George is a good immigration scholar who differs from me on what we think our preferred policy views on migration are. But if you look at the difference between the actual empirical consequentialist claims we believe about immigration, it's very small compared to what the vast majority of people believe about the impacts of immigration on the United States economy and other native-born people in the United States. So first of all, a critic like Borjas would not say, unlike an economic ignoramus like Lou Dobbs say, that immigration will turn us into a third-world country and make us poorer. What Borjas says is, the native-born people in the United States become wealthier because of migration, but as a percent of the overall economy, it's fairly small. And then they'll say, we could lose that and would still be wealthy and it's not that bigger consequences. But on net, it's still a gain. And now the reason it's small is for a couple of reasons, one of which is that we have quantitative restrictions, severe quantitative restrictions on immigration right now. Another is that a large chunk of the people who are foreign-born in the United States are here illegally and cannot use their skills as well as they might otherwise if they were in the legal market. We could increase these gains, but it's still going to be modest, at least without redistributionist policies, as a percent of the overall economy. Perhaps the most popular objection in the United States is, they're going to steal our job. I do the South Park voice, but I can't do the South Park voice. If I were a comedian, I probably could. But they're going to steal our jobs. For this, there's absolutely no evidence. So it's a classic case of the French economist Frédéric Bastiat, of the seen and the unseen. So you can put a camera on someone who used to work in landscaping, and now there's an immigrant working in landscaping, and he's lost his job. That's the seen. The unseen are the jobs that are created because American labor is freed up to do other tasks. American capital is freed up to go into other areas. So we know these are real. It's just harder to put a camera on. Just thought experiment. Just think since 1950, what has happened to the United States labor market? We've roughly tripled the size of the labor force. Massive entry of baby boomers, women, and post-1965 immigrants into the workforce. If there were like a fixed pool of jobs, you should see massive long-term structural unemployment. You don't see this, because as we add more workers, we add more jobs. This isn't to say that it isn't without transition costs for people as they get reallocated, but on net, the number of jobs doesn't shrink. In fact, it's the same as the case for international trade in goods and services on this margin. It switches to those jobs that we're relatively better suited for relative to the immigrant skills who come here, and that makes us more productive. Which leads to the next objection that comes up. But they're going to depress our wages. They're going to make us poorer. Or they're going to make some workers poorer. So the debate among economists on this is like super focused. After
30-plus years of study after study going back and forth in respectable economic journals about this, not crazy policy studies. It's boiled down to this. People who directly compete with immigrants, might their wages go down as much as negative 7% temporarily and then recover after when they get reallocated? Or is it really 0%? And how long is that temporary? That's the debate. That's the big difference between Borjars and I. What he says, it doesn't make the natives that much wealthier as it stands. It makes us some wealthier, but some high school dropouts, people who don't have a high school diploma, lose temporarily, and it could be as much as negative 7%. That's the range of the debate among scholars who are working on this. It's vastly different than society. Now, I write popular columns sometimes, and I get a fair amount of hate mail, especially when I write on immigration. And I write on sweatshops regularly defending them, so I'm not a stranger to hate mail here. And somebody wrote me at one point on this, and they said, but you obviously don't understand the laws of supply and demand. So it shifts out the supply. Actually, what they wrote me was a whole bunch of swears, and I was drunk, and I responded because I was amused. Usually I just delete it. But then, like, on the second or third iteration of this email, it became coherent, and it was basically immigration increases the supply of labor. If you increase the supply in a supply and demand framework, you're going to push down those wages, and he wasn't good enough to get this point. Overall employment would increase, but native employment would actually decrease. Ed, don't I understand this? Well, it's not as simple as that, because immigrants also, in addition to supplying labor, demand goods and services. If you demand goods and services, somebody must supply those goods and services, which means they have to hire workers, which shifts out the supply, the demand for labor as well. Now it's an empirical question of, do the wages have to decrease? Could they stay the same? Could they go up? Then the next part comes, it's just misrepresentative to say it's the supply of labor. If immigrants are different in their skill set than the native-born population, it's not simply a homogeneous supply of labor that increases. It's labor with different skills than the force of the United States, often low skills. So usually high-skill immigration is the less controversial part of it in the United States. Low skill is more controversial. This, to me, is baffling, actually. When I look around the world, relative to global supply of low-skill labor and low-skill tasks to be done, the United States is tremendously short on low-skill labor relative to the rest of the globe. We still have low-skill tasks that need to be done. This means high-skilled people have to do those tasks. And in fact, they have to use capital, physical capital, that could be used somewhere else in the economy in order to accomplish those tasks. That means we're providing low-skill services in a way that's not a very efficient way to do it. If more low-skilled people are here, it frees up more high-skilled people to use their high skills elsewhere and to use more capital elsewhere. Think just thought experiment on this, of a very simple example. How many women leave the workforce who are college-educated and have high skills to care for their children who might, if cheaper nannies were available from other parts of the world in the United States, not leave the workforce? Now, did that low-skill laborer provide the high skills? No. Did they free up the native-born person to use their high skills doing something that they otherwise might not have been able to do? Yes. This makes us more productive. In fact, the economics underlying this are identical to the economics that underlie the basic free case for global trade in goods and services that's been made for over 200 years since Adam Smith. In fact, when thinking about this, for someone to take the position of defending quantitative restrictions on immigration, as soon as we're going to defend a quantitative restriction, we also are then going to have to determine who gets in and who gets out. But who has the knowledge to internationally plan the global labor market? They're being put in the position of a Soviet commissar who has to plan the domestic market for shoe production, iron production, and every other thing. How do you set the right quantity? Mark's probably going to tell you immigration was good in the United States, and in the 19th century we had an expanding frontier and we needed more labor. But now we don't. Really? How do we now know that? I'm not privileged to this information. What I can observe is when one person trades with another, that means that they viewed the value of that good or service more highly than any of the other available alternatives to them. When a farmer employs a Mexican farm worker to come work for them, when someone employs an Indian software engineer, just saying there's some American who could have done it does not mean that we did not need that laborer. It means, actually, if the price system is functioning, that the person who was best suited to provide that happened to be born in another country. There is no individual outside of the market process that evaluates this who can know the answer to it ahead of time. Andrew, in his opening, talked about Canada and why the Liberals haven't moved to Canada, who said, oh, my God, Trump's getting elected. Guess what? I can't move to Canada. I put myself through this, not because I was planning to, because, dude, it's cold. New York's as cold as I need right now. I live in Texas. But aside from that, I was curious to find out. Thing is, you have different language skill points that you get, family connection points, occupational points. Turns out, well, as some of my family members might say, I'm the type of doctor who can't actually help people. So an economics doctor doesn't score many points under this system. If I was a medical doctor, I would be able to migrate to Canada right now. But who in the Canadian Central Planning Politburo knows that an economist could not be useful? If a free market institute in Canada, I run a free market institute in Texas, desired to hire me and had people who wanted to pay me, wouldn't that be a demonstration that my skills were valuable in Canada? No central planning system is going to be able to optimally plan any sort of international labor market like this. But as soon as you embrace quantitative restrictions on immigration, you are essentially engaging in a central planning problem for a very complicated market with people with very heterogeneous skills that no one mind could ever plan. We need a market process for this, or in more normal terms, we need to allow people to decide whether they want to cooperate or not. Anytime people decide that they want to cooperate in terms of me employing you or employing somebody else or renting my apartment or house to you, the only way we decide if that creates value for people is letting them engage in these mutually beneficial exchanges. Outside of that, there's no process for reconciling what immigration is needed versus what is not. All it is the pretentious plans of one person blindly interfering with the plans of millions of other people who would otherwise find ways to cooperate to make them both better off. We need to move towards a market of voluntary cooperation in international labor markets like this. And doing so would increase the wealth of the natives, the wealth of the immigrants tremendously, and allow us to all be better off while respecting our own fundamental individual rights on this. And I think it's...
1 minute, yeah.
1 minute?
Yeah.
So in thinking about this for just a moment on it, the immigrants gain tremendously. A Haitian out of Haiti, so if we're thinking about global welfare, so far I've taken a very nativist perspective, that it's good for the natives and it's interfering with the natives' rights. From a humanist perspective who cares about the welfare of people around the globe, there's nothing even close that you could do for the global people, for people around the globe who are impoverished by accident of birth in bad environments, who could move elsewhere and use their human capital in ways that they couldn't otherwise. A Haitian increases his income by 1,000% when he moves from Haiti to the United States. If you're a nativist who does not care about them at all, you're thoroughly uncreative if you can't think of ways of redistributing some of that big gain from a Haitian to whatever problem in the United States that you see caused for a native by them benefiting from interacting with other natives here. So I think both from the perspective of utilitarianism, of caring about people around the globe, or people in the United States, we're better off.
All right, there's it. Oh, that's all. Thank you, Ben. Mark Krikorian, 15 minutes to speak against the proposition.
Thank you, Gene. Being in a group of libertarians in a dark basement in de Blasio's New York reminds me of when I was a student in the Soviet Union in the mid-1980s. I was a student in the Soviet Union, yes, in the late 84 to 86. I also have a book, The New Case Against Immigration, Both Legal and Illegal, published by Penguin in 2008. It's available for 1 cent in the digital remainder bin in Amazon, for those of you who are interested. So the goal of immigration policy, at least, you know, based on the premise of the question we're debating, at least one of the goals of immigration policy is to protect Americans. Because the question as it was posed, remember, is remove numerical limitations except for terrorists and criminals and disease carriers. So implicit in there is that immigration does, in fact, serve a protective function. for Americans. The question is, are numerical limits an appropriate part of that protective function? My opponent says no, I argue yes. In effect, what we're arguing here is not so much open borders, but rather two different perspectives. One which says that anyone should be allowed to move here unless there's some reason not to let them in. My perspective is the opposite. No one should be allowed to move here unless there's a specific reason we should allow them in. In other words, everyone with exceptions, no one with exceptions. But before I talk a little more about that, nothing personal, but this is something libertarians often fall prey to, is sort of the sophomore year midnight bull session in the dormitory as opposed to grappling with actual numbers and actual reality as it is. And so I think it would help to look at what are some of the numbers that we're talking about here. Because as a wise man once said who was not listened to, numbers are of the essence. That was Enoch Powell, by the way, a prophet who had no honor in his own country. Each year, about 1.5 million people from abroad move here to live. That's people, new legal immigrants coming as green card holders. That includes so-called temporary long-term people, a very large share of whom end up becoming permanent immigrants, and it includes new illegal immigration. So it's about 1.5 million people a year come here. And this is with the numerical limits we do have, and as poorly enforced as they are, they do in fact succeed in reducing numbers. This is one of the claims I often hear from libertarians, is that none of this stuff really matters. You can build the 14-foot wall and people will buy 15-foot ladders. That basically immigration controls are futile because they can't do anything about it, so we should just lie back and pretend to enjoy it. The fact is that our immigration controls do in fact succeed in dramatically reducing the number of people moving here who otherwise would come here. And to get some ideas of what those numbers would be, they would be vastly higher if we eliminated all numerical caps on immigration. Gallup routinely polls people abroad on this, and they find they focus group and or poll people supposedly in their telling more than 150 countries of the world, and they routinely find well over 600 million people who tell pollsters that they would move to the West if they could. Although I suspect the 30 or 40 countries they're missing probably or include some of the places where people would be even more likely to leave. I'm not sure how you do polling in Niger, for instance. But so we're talking 600 plus million people want to move to orderly developed societies somewhere. United States is always the number one destination, 140, 150 million people, according to Gallup's telling, would move to the United States if they could. In other words, if there were no numerical caps. Surely not all of those people would come if presented with the actual opportunity to do so. On the other side, if the United States were the only country to eliminate its numerical caps, huge numbers of people who pick Canada, Australia, or somewhere else would come here instead. And what's more, migration has a kind of accelerating or cumulative effect so that people who now don't think about coming to the United States, once their hairdresser's brother-in-law's neighbor moves here and sends a letter back or whatever it is they do, and you know they Skype about how wonderful it is in America, then people who never planned on it will. So we're talking about potential of an enormous number of people and a realistic potential, not some fake scare numbers I'm making up, but you could easily end up with 100 million people a decade moving to the United States with no numerical caps. Remember, this is a country with 320 million people. So in a decade, a one-third increase in the population nationally and not spread out evenly across the country but focused in already densely populated areas would represent a kind of revolutionary policy, something that is the very opposite of the kind of prudential approach to governing and lawmaking that any lawmaker in a democracy, whatever their views about specific issues, should be focused on. Now, we have real-world examples of unlimited immigration. Puerto Rico is one. Puerto Rico has open borders with the United States, and something like a quarter of its population moved here. We were assured until a few years ago, when I brought this example up, that there are now Puerto Rico had achieved, or migration from Puerto Rico had achieved a kind of stability, a kind of equilibrium. There were people going back, you know, to retire, and there were new people coming, but it was roughly stable. Well, what we found is over the past couple of years, Puerto Rico is even more misgoverned than the rest of the United States, and emigration has exploded from Puerto Rico. So the idea that you know, a quarter of the population, or more, a third of the population of various nearby countries that are, you know, relatively poorly governed, whether it's Cuba or Mexico or Central America, should give pause to anyone talking about this idea of unlimited immigration. And remember, this is Puerto Rico, where U.S. government policy for generations has been to pay people to stay and not move to the United States. We have an extraordinarily generous policy of welfare toward Puerto Rico. In fact, that was one of the main arguments for the statehood movement at one point. They called it statehood for the poor, meaning keep the welfare coming from the mainland. And also we've had for a long time generous tax subsidies to create jobs in Puerto Rico so people would move here. And despite all of that, between a quarter and a third of the entire population has left and moved to the United States. Another example we have more recently of open borders, or at least for a temporary period of ending numerical caps, was Germany, where Angela Merkel basically said anyone who was a Syrian or pretended to be a Syrian or could buy a Syrian passport or whatever could just enter Germany, no questions asked. Germany got 1.1 million people in 1 year, and it was only stopped by aggressive state action from Turkey all the way up to Germany and all the countries in between. These were not people coming to freely associate with employers in Germany. These were people who logically and perfectly plausibly decided that sleeping in the street in Germany beat having a job in Yemen. And there's a lot of places like that, and there's a lot of people like that, and the idea that this is simply a matter of economic migration is, I think, a mistake. So in the past, we did not have numerical limits. This is often an argument, again, that libertarians bring up. You know, we only had the first numerical limits 100-plus years ago. The reason for that, of course, is that the oceans limited immigration for us. In an era of more limited communications and transportation technology, it was simply more difficult to get here, and there were whole sections of the world that simply nobody came here from. None of that is true anymore. You can get anywhere. You can get to the United States from anywhere in the world in a matter of hours. And so the oceans don't, and distance doesn't serve the limiting purpose it used to, which is why we need to have statutorily imposed numerical limits instead. So we're talking about, you know, potentially 100 million people in a decade moving to the United States. So what? What is the what are the harmful consequences of that? That the American people should be protected from through this policy of immigration limitations. Well, I think the way to start thinking about that is, what kind of society do we want? Because in a sense, all government policies are directed in one way or another toward either helping shape society in a way that we broadly find amenable, or at least preventing or mitigating developments that we find problematic. And I think that this, we have a broadly shared sense of between the center right and the center left of the kind of society we want. I think most people want a society with a strong sense of mutual responsibility to our fellow citizens, a large middle class with a smaller rather than a larger gap between rich and poor, opportunities for upward mobility for the poor and for the marginalized, some system of social provision for those who fall on hard times. I'm a conservative, so I want a more demanding, tighter system of social provision for the poor, but the concept of that is not only, I think, broadly shared as in a normative sense, but it's also literally unavoidable in any kind of modern society. There is no such thing, and never will be any such thing, as a modern society that does not have a significant element of a welfare state in its component. And modern standards of first world orderly behavior, like residential occupancy rules and follow, traffic rules, driving between the lane markers on the roads, that sort of thing. These are not things that simply spring out of societies normally. I mean, I was in Soviet Armenia, which was essentially the Soviet Middle East. The highway, I remember a highway on the way to my dormitory was three lanes. It had the line markers very nicely painted on the road, and there were at least five or six cars abreast driving up this highway because this was not the first world. So unlimited immigration would undermine all of these goals that I think are very broadly shared among our population about what kind of society we want. Ben is right about the net economic benefit for Americans as a whole. But net hides a lot of things. It's one of those words that can get you in trouble unless you're disaggregating what you're talking about. National Academies of Sciences did the most recent look at the costs and benefits of immigration, and their conclusion, roughly sort of rounding the numbers, was that there is something like a $50 billion benefit to Americans as a whole, to the native-born as a whole, a net benefit of a little more than $50 billion. Well, it sounds like a lot. If I had $50 billion, I mean, I'd take 10% of that and I'd be happy. But there's three mitigating points here. One is, and Ben pointed this out, it's really not very much money in a vast economy like ours. The National Academies of Science estimated that current immigration, remember, this is not open borders, this is the immigration we have now, increases income for natives on average by 0.3%, 0.3%. So it's small, but if that's all there were to it, it's still, the sign, it's a plus, it's not a minus, so that's not so bad. But the second point, and this is where the disaggregating is essential, is that $50 billion in net benefit is the result of a vast transfer of wealth from the poor to everyone else. Roughly speaking, again, those who compete with immigrants lose something like $500 billion of their income, whereas everyone else gains something like $550 billion, the extra coming from the efficiencies brought about by immigration, so that the net benefit is $50 billion. So the question really here, in a sense, is a kind of moral question. Is it right for us to pursue a policy that beggars the poor beggars the poor to benefit everyone else? And the last point here that mitigates this net benefit is that it doesn't count the extra social service costs, the welfare and other costs that poor workers always impose in a modern society. And the National Academy of Sciences did a variety of estimates with different assumptions, up to a $300 billion cost a year in extra social services. The point is, the economic benefit is totally wiped out by the social service costs.
Thank you, Mark. Now, 5 minutes. 5 minutes from Ben Powell of rebuttal. Ben, take it away.
All right. Thank you, Gene, and thank you, Mark. So first, let's just point out a couple of things here. About half of Mark's remarks were all just about the numbers of how many people are coming in. These in of themselves tell us nothing about goodness or badness. More coming in if they're a benefit or a bigger benefit. More coming in if they're a cost or a bigger cost. So just spending a lot of time talking about how many people tells us nothing in and of itself. The key questions of what he was getting to his last 5 minutes here, are there the net costs for the natives, which there's not, there's net benefits. But let's focus on a couple of these about the purely the topic of the debate of should we have quantitative restrictions and other things that could go with this. Listen, pointing out that many of them will be, that Germany, million people come in and some want to sleep in the street. Our debate is not about who can sleep in the street. If you want to have a rule that says no one can sleep in the street in the United States, no quantitative restrictions on immigration. Anybody you catch sleeping in the street, throw them out of the country. That's not a quantitative restriction on migration. That's saying you can't reside on public property, which
I don't think is a ridiculous rule to have. Ditto, if you want to be a real immigration enforcement Nazi on this, lane markers and roads. Yep, violate the lane markers and roads, we deport you. That's not a quantitative restriction on immigration. That's a saying we're going to limit one third world consequence on natives that we don't like. Okay, let's work around those, but let's not do it by saying we're going to exclude by quantitative limits millions of people around the globe who would like to come here who won't drive across the lanes. That, I think, is a really immoral way to enforce lane marking in the United States. Now, I think the most important point of these that he's talking about, and this is where we're at the economics of it, is that there's a net benefit to the United States, but there's a transfer between some of the least skilled people in the United States and consumers of immigrant services. First of all, we need to be clear that it's consumers of immigrant services, which is on average all of the Americans. It's not just rich capitalists who benefit here. Who are we really talking about? It's not the National Academy of Science, which is like a static equilibrium model that they adjust. But when we look at the wage effects, and this is that debate I was talking about, might high school dropouts lose -7% who compete with immigrant workers? And how long does it last? Is it temporary? This is a fairly small effect. And in fact, for looking at upward mobility, if you're a low-skill American who's debating whether to drop out of college, and you know that there's lots of immigrants who can come into this country, might this give you a better incentive for upward mobility to go ahead and stay through high school and get more of an education and more skills so that you don't directly compete with them? I don't think that this necessarily makes native-born Americans lose their upward mobility. And in fact, on average, for the middle class, is going to make a middle-class American wealthier. Now, the last part of this, and that's what I'll spend my last couple minutes on here, but the social services. This is something that's a tension with classical liberals, conservatives, libertarians about this always. Milton Friedman said, you know, it's just obvious, so open immigration and a welfare state are incompatible. I think a couple points on this, but I think it's thoroughly uncreative. If we're focusing just on the net benefits to the native-born of $50 billion, $100 billion, whatever you want to make that number, but that there's massive overall benefits, many of which accrue to the immigrants, if that's all your objection is, fiscal policy is changeable. You could do something like wall off immigrants from a portion of a welfare state, but if you find that undesirable, that doesn't have to be the way that you deal with it. How about an immigration surtax? So all immigrants that come in will pay, and I'm going to make up a number now, but Mark can make up whatever number actually makes the number work for him, of 10% of their income has to be paid in federal income taxes to go towards all welfare costs of all other immigrants. Some of those immigrants are entrepreneurs who earn lots. They have to pay big. Some immigrants are going to be consumers of social services who don't pay much in this. Whatever number you need to make that, how many of the global poor who are trapped in hellholes around the world who would like to better their lives and their families' lives by moving here would say, yeah, you know what? I'll take a 10% income tax hit in the United States with no exemptions in addition to whatever the other federal income tax is as an immigration surtax to deal with my potential welfare costs or those of other immigrants who are given this opportunity. That's a much more humane and efficient way to deal with that potential problem.
Thank you, Ben. In 5 minutes, we're going to turn it over to questions. So get ready with your questions, and you'll be lining up over there. Mark, 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Several sort of staccato points. Number one, the reason I spent time in talking about what the actual real-world numerical consequences of this would be is that the numbers are revolutionary. This is a revolutionary policy, and the consequences themselves would be revolutionary. If you like Trump, if you like Marine Le Pen, just wait to see what's going to happen when numerical limits on immigration are eliminated. There is no way it can be done without either violent backlash or tyrannical suppression of the native-born population's objection to it. This is, ironically, the only way to impose this libertarian ideal of unlimited immigration is through the barrel of a gun. Number two, let's see, the welfare state. You often hear this. It's like, there's nothing wrong with mass immigration. Ending the welfare state won't fix. My reaction to that usually is, okay, do that, and then give me a call. There is no way this is going to happen. And the idea of taxing immigrant income to compensate for this is ridiculous. The reason 51% of immigrant households are using taxpayer-funded, means-tested government services is that they don't have any money. They don't pay any income taxes. So a surtax on nothing is still nothing. And in fact, if anything, a surtax, even if they could pay it, may well push them into a low enough income bracket that they would then collect welfare. So this is no kind of solution at all. And why is Haiti a hellhole? It's not a hellhole because the Haitians aren't here. It's because, for whatever reason, in Yemen or in Haiti or in Afghanistan, for a variety of cultural and historical reasons, those countries don't work very well. The dirt here isn't magic. We have developed through centuries, stretching back into England, institutions, both cultural mores, like the nuclear family, which was an unusual thing in the Middle Ages, but was widespread in England and in Northwestern Europe, as well as political and economic institutions that are the reason for our prosperity. It's not the dirt. And as Borjas points out in critiquing this idea of open borders with double world income, the institutions that increase the productivity of people here compared to in the third world would likely not survive the movement of 5 or 6 billion people to the developed part of the world, which is what that doubling of world GDP presupposes. Not to mention the fact that the transport costs 5 billion people would eliminate the entire benefit that this FACO estimate comes up with. So why are these places hellholes? It's not because of the dirt. It's because of the institutions and the cultures of the places that people are coming from in the first place. And so what kind of immigration policy would I call for? Ben is right that this central planning idea that they have in Canada, that much of our own immigration policy is based on, is ridiculous. You know, that somehow we can know what the prevailing wage is and some bureaucrat can decide that this particular occupation is usable and will benefit and that occupation is not. That's all a lot of Soviet-style baloney. It's true. If that worked, the Soviet Union would still be around. This is why the alternative, it seems to me, the ideal alternative to no numerical limitations is not zero immigration, but zero-based budgeting immigration. No immigration for its own sake. A modern society like ours does not actually need any immigration. So, but you start at zero, and I build up from that. The final chapter of my world-shaking book, available for a penny on Amazon, goes through this in some detail. But no immigration, and then decide which categories of people have such a compelling reason to be let in that we let them in anyway. And just the short version of that is husbands, wives, and little kids of U.S. citizens, and a handful of genuine Einsteins, however you want to define that, top people in the planet in their fields. And that's about it. But that's still 350,000, 400,000 people a year, which is a not insignificant level of immigration. It's just not immigration for its own sake.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah. So please start lining up. There's a microphone over there to ask your questions. As you're lining up, I'm going to ask take moderator's prerogative to ask a question first to Ben. Ben, please keep it talking down so people can hear. Ben, with respect to the idea of the welfare state, the challenge was that you cannot modify the welfare state and ask immigrants to pay 10% of their income when they're already so abysmally poor. Could you address that issue?
Sure. So this is a tweak you can do whichever way, Mark. You can modify it however you like. Saying 10% of zero is still zero is a numerical truism, but not all immigrants earn zero. Some of them are entrepreneurs who earn a whole lot. So if you'd like to make it a 10% immigrant surtax, 20%, 25%, you pick your number, once they hit a success threshold, and make that number big enough to compensate for the others. We don't need a numerical restriction because of the welfare state. Immigrants can net finance their portion of the welfare state, their self, in principle under this. If you want to just tweak the numbers to your heart's content, you can find an equilibrium that makes immigrants self-sustaining, paying their own portion of the welfare state that doesn't involve a welfare benefits cut or a wall off or some other fantasy that libertarians have.
Yeah, maybe. I'd have to have that demonstrated to me. The majority of illegal immigrants specifically, and they make up a quarter of the immigrant population, are high school dropouts. a significant portion of the immigrant population are naturalized citizens, which we're not going to have separate taxes on naturalized citizens. That's probably constitutionally suspect.
We can make that
but
rule up.
The level of that of the taxation would have to be, I mean, I would like to see a real world estimate that actually was able to demonstrate that there is some level, a realistic level of taxation on the foreign born that would completely compensate for all means-tested government services. Maybe there is one. I'm not persuaded that there are enough wealthy immigrants for that to be true.
So let's start with the baseline of where we are now, because basically the studies are about a wash on this. Anyone that's a responsible study that does the dynamic effects and the generational effects of an immigrant's taxes over their lifetime versus the social services they consume, some are positive, some are negative, they're clustered around zero, and they're not very big. So the tweak in principle doesn't have to be big to solve this.
Yeah, but the dynamic effects is one of those weasel words that then creates potential, in other words, that creates an opportunity to minimize these costs. What essentially you're saying is that welfare is a self-funding program. And if it were a self-funding program, then let's just expand it. Welfare is not a self-funding program. It can't be.
Let's just be clear about this. My child, Raymond, 7 years old, he's a welfare queen. He's never paid a tax dollar in his life, but nobody would sit around here being like, oh, he's a tax drain. Any responsible person would say, well, how much do we think he's going to spend in income over his in life, generate in taxes? How much would that create growth elsewhere? That's the dynamic effect. We'll net all these things out. That's the responsible way anybody counts this. And when they do this, it's about a wash. Just like my boy Raymond, about a wash.
So in other words, you're saying...
I wish I'd wash more.
Welfare is a self-funding program. This is what it amounts to, that it doesn't actually cost taxpayers on a whole anything. And our welfare system is really, it's a wealth transfer system. The top half of the population essentially buys a Mercedes every year for the bottom half of the population.
You're saying a different thing. A welfare system is not what I'm talking about. The contributions of immigrants, both those who are net payers and net subtractors over their lifetime, is about a wash. And if we did this for all domestic-born people and netted them all, it would also be about a wash. Some would win, some would lose. But within the category of foreign-born, it's also a wash. Some foreign-born win, some foreign-born lose, but it doesn't have to be a net burden on the existing native-born. That's what I'm saying. These are different things.
The National Academy of Sciences did 6 different scenarios of what the net costs and benefits are. They were always negative, all of them.
Those are static, non-generational ones that they did, that Borjars did himself. It did crazy things like assume that the cost of aircraft carriers goes up when we have more people. That's a public good. When we have more people, we don't need more aircraft carriers.
Okay, guys... Mark, I should get to the first question. I see a questioner there. Please take it away.
Okay. You mentioned that the benefits of immigration are diffuse while the costs are concentrated on poor. You characterize that as a moral issue. My question is, by what moral standard should I be more compassionate about a poor American than a poor African, Asian, or Mexican? And isn't it unduly jingoistic for me to do so?
No. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because that really is the core issue here, is do we have a greater responsibility to our fellow citizens than we do to foreigners? This is not to say we have no responsibility whatsoever to the rest of humanity. That's something that is a separate question. But do we have a greater responsibility to fellow members of our national community? And that is a normative question. My answer is absolutely yes. I have a greater responsibility to my own family than I do to you all, and I have a greater responsibility to my fellow citizens than I do to foreigners. This is only in the most... how shall I put this? I mean, only at the edges of the political system, among libertarians and among real leftists, is there any dispute that we have more responsibility a requirement of some level of solidarity expressed in some fashion to our fellow citizens than we do to foreigners.
So just a quick point on this, and it's beyond the science of economics, but it's the art of welfare comparisons between people and philosophical judgments here. But not all art is equally good art. Some art's bad art. So to me, it seems weird to say that, well, if we take the standard of we should care about the welfare of Americans more, well, on net, Americans gain from migration. Some lose, but on net, when we add up the winners versus the losers, there's more net win. That's the total pie increasing for the native born. If we're going to heavily weight on just the high school dropouts who might compete temporarily, then we're saying we're going to weight people's welfare by income, and we care about the less fortunate more than the more fortunate. Fair enough, but if that's the case, doesn't the welfare of the very, very poor in the other parts of the world count too? And count something more than maybe the poor Americans? It seems like a weird discontinuity of who we care about to say not net Americans, just poor Americans, not poor people from outside America. That's like a weird art.
Well, no, it's not. I care about my fellow citizens, and I care especially about my fellow citizens who are the least able to cope with the challenges of reality. Some of those people are, you know, high school dropouts. Frankly, you know, at this point, if you're a high school dropout, there's probably a reason for that. 100 years ago, there were a lot of high school dropouts. Nowadays, you probably have some serious cognitive or human capital limitations if you're not able to make it out of high school. I think I have a responsibility, and that we as a people have a responsibility. Anyone who's marginal to the economy is harmed by high levels of immigration. That's not just high school dropouts. That's young people with no work history. That is handicapped, disabled people. That's ex-cons trying to get back into the world and trying to clean up their act. That's racial or ethnic minorities who, for a variety of reasons, are considered less desirable by employers. Anyone who is marginal to the labor market is harmed by immigration, and those are the very people we as a society have a greater responsibility towards.
Do you weigh in the balance that many of those poor people abroad would consider the people you just described fabulously rich? Many of them are starving. Those abroad who might help with immigration.
We help those people. We can help those people in other ways. Immigration is not the way to help them. They may well consider our poor to be...
It's not a good way to help them. Okay, all right. Yeah. The question.
Hi, I care about American rich people and American corporations. And would American corporations be better off by not having employees who are immigrants? Would the restaurant industry, would the construction industry, would the manufacturing industries be better off if they were not allowed to hire immigrants?
First of all, it's not a question of whether they're allowed to or not allowed to. Would they have access to immigrant labor is what you mean. If it all disappeared tomorrow, that would be disruptive and deeply problematic, obviously. But they're doing okay now without open borders, but with a high level of immigration. If we quintupled immigration, they would then say, we can't survive if we had only 1.5 million people moving to the United States. In other words, the businesses adjust to the availability of labor. Would they like it if we reduced immigration, in my scenario, cutting it in half, say, annual immigration from what it is now? No, they wouldn't like it, but, you know, that's okay. Congress, the job of Congress is not to procure labor for McDonald's. The job of Congress is to set parameters within which the free market then operates, and that includes immigration as well as labor rules. Businesses were a lot happier 100 years ago to be able to hire 11-year-olds to work in their mills. They don't anymore. The labor standard has changed, not merely through legislation, but really sort of through a social cultural change. They've adapted to it. They live with it. That's one of the... Is there a cost to barring employers from hiring 11-year-olds in factories? There probably is, but it's a cost that we as a society are willing to pay.
Comment, Ben and Dr.
Yeah, so just quickly, you can imagine yourself, if your income were cut in half, Would you survive and would you cope? Of course you would. That doesn't mean it's optimal. Saying that if we cut immigration or we didn't expand it, businesses would cope and adjust. Of course they would. That's what they do on the margin all the time. But that doesn't mean that they make us all better off than they could if they had access to the real scarcity of labor. What we're talking about here is a fundamental type of protectionism that misprices labor and screws up the way that businesses create value for everybody else that makes us poorer. That's what this is. It isn't setting parameters for the free market. It is not having a free market and therefore getting inefficient results that don't make us as wealthy as it could.
Next question.
I'd like to, my question is based around Ben Powell's...
Addressed to whom?
It was based around the bringing up Bastiat, the seen and the unseen.
Oh, okay.
And that, we were talking about, for example, the benefits to U.S. corporations, to home builders, and so on, that these are benefits that accrue to people in the upper middle class and above, whereas what I would put out is, are there costs that are cultural costs that are borne primarily by people that are not at the top, and those are the unseen costs? And I'd like maybe both of you to talk about, is there, or respond to the question, is there a cultural cost to unrestricted immigration that that is not easily assessed in terms of, say, a GDP, or and what is the value of that, if so?
Ben, you why don't you take that question, Ben?
So culture is always evolving and changing. It's a spontaneous order that can't be planned by anybody. This is going to be true in a world of zero migration or in a world of much migration. Things that you think of as cultural goods are often things that are the product of prior international trade, either in migration or in goods and services. I mean, what's more quintessentially Italian than spaghetti, except noodles come from the Orient and then get combined with ideas about Italian cuisine. So I think thinking about locking in any particular cultural equilibrium of these things like this is never going to actually happen anyway, and is just not realizing how we came to get to be where we are today anyway. So things are going to change one way or another, and I don't think anybody can plan it any better than anybody else.
Well, look, what is the culture of a country other than the assumptions and worldviews and behaviors of the people who live in it? And, if you're going to import 100 million people who don't care about driving between the lane markers on a highway, there's only so many tickets you can write before you have changed the way things are done in that society. I'm using a trivial example, but the point is, there's a reason Yemen and Afghanistan are what they are. And if everyone from Yemen and Afghanistan moves to the United States, our country will become more like Yemen and Afghanistan. I would prefer to avoid that.
I'm okay with you throwing out the lane violators. Just let them in and see who does it first.
My point is, practically speaking, you cannot maintain the political will to maintain that standard when you have changed the population's views on that issue so radically. If you let in 15 Yemenis who don't obey traffic laws, you can impose your will on them. If you import 15 million people who don't have any idea there even are traffic laws, it becomes much more difficult to impose our values on them.
Next question.
Yeah, I'm going to, this is for both of you. There is a refugee problem in the United States. I'm going to speak very fast with the questions. This is an extremely difficult issue. A segment of the population driven by ignorance, hysteria, and the fear want to keep all refugees out of the U.S. coming from certain countries. Another issue, which is the most controversial, is whether to deport illegal immigrants who have been living here for years, have no criminal records, and have had children who are Americans.
About refugees?
What do you think about deporting parents and siblings and separating them from their children? Do you think it's cruel and heartless?
First of all, there's several points here. One is immigrants break up their families when they move here to begin with. Illegal immigrants who have U.S. illegal immigrants who have U.S. born kids are grown-ups. They have made their decision, and if they end up paying the consequences for their violation of immigration law, their children, of course, are free to stay if they're U.S. born, if they have some relative or some other way to stay. But, you know, kids should go with their parents and they can come back in the future if they're U.S. citizens. This idea that immediately coming here, having a kid makes you immune from the workings of immigration law, even under Ben's scenario, would be ridiculous, because we're still going to be deporting some people. And if you have a kid here and are undeportable, then any immigration standards, whether they're numerical limits or whether they're other kinds of criteria about criminality and the rest of it, none of them means anything because they don't apply to you.
Ben?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. The refugee part, I'll take the first question. You did the second question part. And I just say the refugee part, in terms of the potential harm, the probabilities are just astronomically low here. If we do all categories of immigrants, it's something like a 1 in 3.6 million people will die of a terrorist act by a foreign-born person in the United States. If you get struck by lightning, it's a 1 in 175,000 chance. And of those, the foreign-born one, it's like the lion's share. If it's 1 in 3, it's like almost all of that comes from people on tourist visas. It's not refugees. That's just not the big risk over the last 40 years in the United States on this.
And that, just to sort of get in a plug here, I've been writing for a while now about the refugee issue. And the key issue, it seems to me, you're right, is not security. I mean, it's not irrelevant, but it's not the key issue. The key issue is, frankly, the immorality of refugee resettlement, because it cost us 12 times as much to resettle a refugee in the United States from the Middle East as it does, according to the UN's own estimates, to take care of them in the Middle East. Each refugee we take into the United
States... Ask your questions. The next question is going to...
Each refugee we take into the United States represents 11 other people who are not being helped with that money. Refugee resettlement is a selfish policy to make us feel better while misallocating whatever limited pool of resources we're going to spend on refugee protection. We're giving one person caviar instead of 12 people rice and beans.
Interesting point. Next question, please. Next question.
Hi. I think it's particularly funny that you both mentioned Haiti, because my mother is a Haitian immigrant who came here illegally while she was pregnant with me. My question is for Ben. All right. Oh, I guess I'm a minority in more ways than one, because my life experiences has made a conservative out of me. So my question is for Ben. How, given the fact that you mentioned earlier a fundamental tenet for your belief that your belief in free migration is the freedom of association, correct? Now, how will that idea persist if you allow migration from countries that don't share that same principle?
So I think this is...
I believe a recent study committed by Swedish economists showed that it was mostly Western countries that were least likely to answer that they were uncomfortable living around other races. So,
thank you. This is a great question.
Your question's clear. Thanks very much.
I appreciate it. And you are, in part, an illustration of my answer to it, that you came up here and self-identified as a conservative who I think will have some sort of free market values in the United States. That the people who come as migrants are not a random sample of the origin country, and that their descendants aren't necessarily either. So if I think about the most anti-socialist group in the United States, it's migrants from Cuba who left Castro and came here. Those are the people I think reinforce American values of free markets and individualism better than the native-born population probably does. Now, the Cubans are probably an extreme example of this, but the question that you bring up is the cutting edge of the economics debate among real scholars who work on this versus the public policy debate, and it's one that I'm engaged in with George Borjas and Michael Clemens and others on this issue. And it's an empirical question that demands empirical answers, and what I'd say is the early studies on this find countries become a little bit more economically free as they have a greater proportion of stock of immigrants and flow of immigrants over long periods of time.
Wait a minute. The fact is, in the United States, all survey research shows that immigrants and the children of immigrants are disproportionately big government Democrats. I mean, that's just, this is the way, there's no getting around this. Often what you'll see is, well, Hispanics are Catholic and they're anti-abortion. That's actually not all that true. Hispanics overall, so we're talking about mostly, overwhelmingly, immigrants and children of immigrants we're talking about here. So the adult Hispanics respond to surveys. A few ticks more pro-life than average. Asian immigrants are a few ticks more pro-choice than average. And neither one of them votes on those kind of social issues as opposed to economic issues. And Pew did a survey of your opinion, favorable or unfavorable, of various words and concepts. And what they found was that Hispanic respondents, again, Hispanic adults, are the majority of them are immigrants or the children of immigrants, had the most positive response to socialism of any of the groups that were polled, including more positive than members who self-identified as supporters of Occupy Wall Street. The fact is, immigration moves our politics anyway to the left.
Yeah, just real quick. The main way that most people measure this is the Democratic affiliation, and that's a product of how Republicans treat a lot of Hispanic migrants, I think.
No, but beyond they've done this on but let's, issues, let's specific
be,
issues.
Let's be clear on this, though, too. It's not at all clear to me that in terms of free markets and American values that the Republicans are any better on net than the Democrats on this.
The difference may not be large, but the idea that we're going to have similar EPA policies, for instance, under President Hillary Clinton, as opposed to even a President Trump, who's sort of as little as least Republican as you can get, is simply not true.
Yep, net it. Now add trade. We're just trading off one margin against another of statism. They're a mixed bag, both parties.
All right, we've got a clash on that one. And thanks for the great question. So next question, please.
Yes. So you had both discussed the welfare state in relation to immigration, and you had also discussed this scenario of you could have, open immigration but completely walling off the welfare state. And, of course, I think completely getting rid of the welfare state completely is obviously a very unpopular proposal, but so is kind of, harshly restricting immigration. So I was thinking, what you guys think of a compromise between you don't necessarily get rid of the welfare state, but you make it impossible for immigrants to get any form of means-tested welfare.
We tried that in 1995. That was about half of the benefits that were projected to come from the welfare reform in 1995 were projected to come from limits on immigrant welfare. Welfare reform overall worked pretty well. That part of it was a complete failure. And the reason is there were time limits on the prohibition for access to welfare among immigrants. So after a while, it didn't even apply to most immigrants. Number two, it didn't apply to their U.S.-born children, the citizen rules did, not the immigrant rules. Thirdly, there was significant increase in naturalization among the immigrant groups that made the highest use of welfare. And fourthly, Congress started dialing all that kind of stuff back. Walling off immigrants from the welfare state is not a comparable policy to reducing immigration. Reducing immigration is very easy. I could write out literally in two pages, eliminating whole categories, the brother and sister category of immigration, the visa lottery, and reduce immigration by 30 or 40%. Literally right now, with the piece of paper I have now. The political will to get that done is harder, but as a governance matter, it's actually very simple. Getting rid of the welfare state or walling it off to the foreign-born is not in any way comparable. It's a much more difficult task and will not be happening.
Mark, dude, seriously? Yeah, with a stroke of a pen, that's so much easier. Why do we have 13 million people in the United States illegally? You can't just change the law of migration and then stop migration from coming that way.
No, but that's reduce it significantly.
To say that it's impossible to write laws in ways that restrict welfare and then say, but I can just use a pen and stop migration, is just fundamentally not true. Both of these things in real-world implementation are going to have difficulties that mean the people who use the pen don't get the results that they want. Now, what I think I've articulated is what I would call the sane conservative, libertarian middle on migration here. I didn't say we have to build a wall around the welfare state. I said maybe we can surtax some of them. If you want to do partly wall around the welfare state, partly surtax them, mix it up however you want. But we're starting at an equilibrium that's pretty close to a zero net of all migrants on welfare state drain anyway. So these are not the big margins around like what the economics or the immigration debate and the impact on the native born is really about. It's kind of a small part of the show.
Next question.
Thanks.
Hi. I spent a lot of time thinking about a question, and then I have to say something quickly. So my question is this. From Mr. Powell, they say the on-paper national debt is $12 trillion, and then there's another estimate that is something like $70 trillion, and then there's Lawrence Kotlikoff, the professor at Boston University, who says the national debt is actually $220 trillion if you figure in promises that we've made that we can't keep. So the question is, it seems to me we have an unsustainable system in this country, and that under your proposal, sir, we would be bringing in large numbers of people to an unsustainable system and make it even worse, and it's going to be lead to a big disaster.
That's the question. Okay, please answer.
Oh, I think you raise an excellent point, and actually maybe it's one of my reservations about immigration because it cuts differently than the way you said it. So I do agree that that the Social Security, Medicare is a Ponzi scheme in the United States that depends on bringing more people in to fuel it. Of course, if I was going to view one drawback of immigration, maybe, it's that it sustains that system longer by bringing more workers into it so that it can perpetuate longer. Myself, I'd rather see it all go away. I'm going to guess that the majority of Americans probably disagree with me on this, but I would view that as one of the negatives of migration, but still favor migration anyway.
Actually, the Social Security Administration itself has said that immigration is, literally, their words were, a very inefficient way of sustaining Social Security. It actually doesn't work very well at all, because what it does is it increases the contributions now up front, but it actually even increases even further the liabilities down the future.
This is the definition of a Ponzi scheme, yes.
That's what I'm saying.
So I just wanted to...
No, but what I'm saying is
wanted to implode quicker.
Yeah, well, the thing is... But that's an important point, because for a lot of libertarians, immigration... The benefit of immigration is that it will destroy the welfare state.
No. It's that it perpetuates the social... The negative is that it perpetuates the Ponzi scheme longer. That's the problem.
Okay. That's fine. I mean, it doesn't even do that very well, actually.
I think you guys just agreed on something. We're running a bit out of time, so please ask your question.
Absolutely. So coming from a libertarian perspective, we're often asked to comment on things that are either exacerbated or created by government interventions in the first place, possibly like this. So, Mark, if we didn't have a social safety net like we do now, if we didn't have the welfare program that we do, and all these items of social safety were provided by the market, would your position on immigration be different, and why?
Let me preface that by pointing out, if there were less gravity, I could jump higher.
Which you can do on the moon, Mars?
Yeah.
So if we build a colony there.
I'm headed there as soon as Elon Musk or whoever it is has flights. The answer is...
I hope they don't put up a wall.
Yeah. See, but there already is a wall. There already is a wall. That's the thing, is you can't get there. Yes and no. Obviously, it would eliminate the whole, the issue of immigrant welfare and the, costs and benefits issue. But number one... This again is one of those sophomore year bull session questions. It's a counterfactual precisely because it literally cannot and will never happen, number one. Number two, the problem with immigration is not a single thing. And this is, as I point out in my earth-shaking bestseller book that's available for 1 cent on Amazon, that all the problems of immigration are the same thing. They're all different facets of the same problem, which is that mass immigration is incompatible with the goals and characteristics of a modern society. That's one part of it. There's other pieces of
it. Ben, you want to make a remark before about that question?
We can go to closing. That's cool.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for all the excellent questions. And then also, again, our speakers are sticking around, so if you have further questions and issues you want to talk about with them, you will be able to. We're going into the... Hey, guys, you guys...
Sorry, riffraff up on stage
I think
here,
this,
dude.
I think this...
You have something to say.
say it.
I don't want any love between you guys for the time being, please. And so 5 minutes for Ben to give us his summary, and that will be followed by Mark giving us his summary for 5 minutes, and then we're going to go to the voting. So listen carefully to what Ben and Mark have to say.
All right. Thank you, Gene, and thank you for giving us this format for it, because in Mark's remarks, he had mentioned that, you know, there's only to go to a no quantitative restriction, it would require the tyrannical oppression of the native born, if I have him quoted here correctly. And I would say it's exactly formats like this and other places where we can have rational discourse on these policies and say, what is actually the effect on the native born of immigration, both costs and benefits, and who? And discussing these things and what the implications are, that will lead people to change their ideas about what optimal immigration is. And ultimately, this is a battle of ideas rather than tyrannical oppression that I think moves us forward. To say that we are going to start from a system of zero and then let people in, and then that this is somehow not planning immigration, is completely disingenuous. It's starting with a quota of zero and then planning immigration up. It doesn't sidestep any of the problems of planning of the Canadian system or any other. It just means Mark gets to make up the things that Mark likes about immigration that he should let in against the plans of 300 and some odd million people in the United States who I otherwise associate with immigrants. That's not planning. It's Mark's plans versus everybody else's plans. And that's what this is really about reconciling. And we know how markets work. It's the reconciliations of people's plans through buying and abstention from buying, from trading and not trading, that allows us to grope our way to the most efficient solutions for those parties concerned. This debate is about allowing that process to happen in the most restricted market around the globe, migration. And that's why the gains are as big as they could be. In fact, I think maybe every major moral system. So economics is a science about consequences, chains of events. It doesn't tell you good or bad. Philosophy tells you about good or bad. But what I would say is most major, if not all, major philosophical ideas of the good and bad, if we take the social science, that means the economic reasoning around immigration seriously, would all point in the same direction, that blanket quantitative restrictions on migration are bad. So from a rights perspective, we should be freely able to associate with people that we don't that we'd like to, and no one has a right to interfere with that. That one seems pretty straightforward to me. Utilitarian, it ain't even close if we're at 50 to 150% of global GDP. Even from a nativist perspective of I don't care about the welfare of the globe, you have to be thoroughly uncreative if we're talking about a doubling of global GDP to not be able to make that in the net benefit of the natives. Instead of worrying about or tweaking about the welfare state of studies that are all basically around zero anyway, small net benefit to natives, high school dropouts, dude, doubling of GDP. Could you tweak policy in such a way that makes that in the benefit of just the natives, even if those are the only people I care about? From a Rawlsian perspective, we care about the welfare of the least well-off. This one's a no-brainer, too. These are like the major philosophical outlooks that we could have. All of them point in the same direction if we appreciate the social science that surrounds the debate among immigration. And what I would say to you is if that George Borjas and I were standing here and debating, and we both take different positions on immigration, our differences in the social science impacts of immigration are like this narrow compared to the gulf that separates most people's misconceptions about immigration of the world. Therefore, we shouldn't have quantitative restrictions on it. Most moral systems would dictate that we eliminate those. Thank you.
Mark. 5 minutes for your summary.
The idea that ending immigration limits will double world GDP actually illustrates the complete unreality of this position. When you actually look at the assumptions in the math, they assume that virtually the entire population of the third world will move to the developed world, to the United States, Europe, and Japan. This is, number one, not going to happen. If it did happen, the costs of moving all of those people would eliminate much, if not all, of the benefit. And the institutions that are the reason for higher productivity in the North would be washed away by the arrival of 5 to 6 billion people from the third world. So my point here is that this using doubling of world GDP is a kind of lollipop to draw you into the van. It's a
It's a false idea which can never happen and therefore is not a legitimate part of debating this policy. The perspective I come at it from, which I referred to quickly at the end of the last question, is that mass immigration is incompatible with the goals and characteristics of a modern society. In other words, what's different today is not the immigrants, it's us. Your grandma from Palermo 100 years ago, it wasn't all that different from somebody coming from Honduras today, but we are different. And the very people focus on different parts of this incompatibility between mass immigration and modern society. Some people talk about the economics. Other people talk about the welfare costs, the security threats, which are different in kind from the past. The assimilation challenges, which are, again, different in kind from the past. But those are all like blind men feeling an elephant and thinking they're touching different things. It's all one whole. It's my unified field theory of immigration limitation. And it is, in fact, true that starting at zero immigration and then allowing certain categories of people is some element of planning. In other words, there's actually the state, through the people, through their elected representatives, determining which categories of people should be let in. But it is an attempt at the narrowest, simplest, least complicated kind of planning. Because what most of immigration would represent under my way of looking at it is spouses and minor children, husbands, wives, and little kids of U.S. citizens. That's an objective fact. There's going to be a lot of fraud. We're going to have to deal with it, but it's either true or it's not. You're either married to this person, you adopted this person, or you didn't. Likewise, with Einstein immigration, I call it in shorthand, there's all kinds of bureaucratic ways of doing that under our current immigration law. You know, have you published articles in journals, what have you? It's also a lot simpler way to do it. Just give anybody who can get 140 on an English language IQ test just gets a green card with the results. But the point is, again, it is a relatively limited and simple way of dealing with this reality that planning doesn't work very well. But nonetheless, what you end up with under that kind of scenario is an immigration flow, hundreds of thousands larger than any other country in the world, permanent immigration for permanent settlement, be something like 400,000, maybe 500,000 a year. It's half what we have now. And yet, it reduces significantly the conflict, the incompatibilities between mass immigration and modern society that we now experience, and obviously would be not only dramatically less than what we experience now, but be orders of magnitude less as far as those conflicts go. Than we would experience with no numerical limitations at all.
Thank you, Mark. This concludes the debate. Excuse me, please. You can talk to the gentleman about this afterwards. The white supremacist question, you're going to think about that. We want you to vote on the proposition. You know what the proposition is. No numerical limitations. I guess Ben would want to add, you know, if you drive off the road and you've got a pattern of that, you can't be let in. And if 15 million people do that, then okay. Then we're voting on the resolution, and we're going to see how things are. Meanwhile, we want to think about some other things. Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Ben, for a civil discussion. And also, thank you to the audience for your civility as well. Thank you for being paying customers. And think about coming back because, you know, you're our Gold Star members.
I was hoping for a pie. I'd been promised somebody would throw a pie at me because I haven't had that done yet, and I want it on video. But
okay, you're looking for that notoriety.
I am.
They used to call it, those people who got subpoenas, they used to call it subpoena envy. You know, everybody wants to get indicted by the government to get his name in the papers. Naomi, it looks like we're closing the voting, and we're going to get the results. And Naomi's handing them to me for me to announce. Okay? Now, okay, so initially, Those who voted yes on the proposition were 41%, and those who voted yes on the proposition afterwards were 49%. So that's the percentage to beat. It looks like those who voted no on the proposition were 30%, and those who voted no afterwards were 40%. I will have to say it's practically a rounding error, guys. On the other hand, I have to say, Mark, it looks like you won by half a percentage point. So congratulations. But both, I will again repeat that 41% voted for, and nearly 50% voted for afterwards. Mark did not win a minority, but he picked up slightly more points by going from about 31 to 47. It's about a half a point advantage. Very much a dead heat. So I want to congratulate both debaters. Thanks very much.